Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
As I was saying a moment ago, we did only last week do a very interesting program about really the Protestant Reformation, and a great focus necessarily was upon the concept of God as we have it in the Western tradition. Tonight we look at a very different tradition, but one which had much influence upon the shaping of our Western tradition, namely the classic, the ancient Greeks, and particularly the stories that gave meaning and structure to their civilization. Stories which also supplied or dealt with figures who were of great religious significance, that is, the gods of the Greek pantheon. We are, in fact, more broadly focused on classic or ancient mythology, of the sort that you find, say, in Bullfinch's mythology, but we're going at it in a somewhat different fashion. A fashion indeed made available for us by Philip Freeman, who's one of our guests, and his new book is Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. Philip Freeman is, of course, a classic scholar. He heads that department at a college, Luther College in, is that Decorah or Decorah?
Decorah.
Decorah, Iowa. And our other guest used to head the classics department at the University of Chicago, where he still serves as a major figure in that department, and that's Jonathan Hall. Let's talk directly about these Greeks. Before we talk about their gods, who were they, in fact? Where did they come from? We know where they lived in what we now call Greece, though when they settled it, it was many separate states, but they were unified by more or less the same language and the same mythology, I suppose. Or am I a little bit off even in that judgment?
No, not really. If you look at the language, we know that Greek is an Indo-European language, and so there was a suggestion that they must have followed other Indo-European migrants from a location that is the object of dispute, but some people would put it somewhere in Armenia now. And that could have been at any time between the Neolithic, around about 7,000, or perhaps as late as 2000. But the interesting thing is that even if there were immigrations of Greek-speaking peoples to the southern Balkans and the islands of the Aegean, they don't actually seem to have started calling themselves Greeks until about the 6th century. So they may have had some sort of sense of communion through common rites, through common language, although they all spoke different dialects. But they didn't really think about themselves as a cohesive single population until fairly late.
But even in the 6th century, they were not a unified nation called Greece.
Not at all.
They were a number of separate city-states. To us, the best known is Athens, mm-hmm. and their sometime enemy Sparta, mm-hmm. and Thebes, and one could name many others. Who did they displace, or did they simply impose their culture upon a prior people?
Well, there were certainly people there before them. You can go to Greece and see the archaeological ruins of people. The Minoans were certainly there in Crete, a very advanced civilization, before the Greeks arrived, about 2000. And then the Greeks eventually moved on to Crete in the middle of the second millennium B.C. So there were plenty of people there. The Hittites were in on the coast of Asia Minor, and not just the Hittites, but many other people who in many ways were more advanced than the Greeks technologically. So it was not a vacuum when they moved in by any means.
But they Greekified or Greekified all of them one way or another.
Yes, but it took time. And even in Homer, he talks about the numbers of different people who still lived in Crete and apparently spoke their own languages.
Now, what do we know about the Greek mythology that is, well, the classic mythology? Though your book, Oh My Gods, I think I may safely say, is more focused upon the Greeks than the Romans.
Absolutely. I throw in a couple of chapters at the end, one chapter on Aeneas, but then one very short chapter on Roman mythology. So it really is Greek mythology with the Roman mythology appendix on it.
What do we know about the origins of that mythology? They didn't invent it out of the whole cloth, did they?
They can't have invented it out of the whole cloth. There must have been ideas going around. But, of course, the urge to try to explain what you can't explain otherwise by reference to a divine being is probably fairly universal. So they would have had ideas that there must be some divine agency behind earthquakes, behind thunderstorms, and so on. And some of the features that they would eventually endow their gods with were probably borrowed from the more advanced civilizations of the Near East, and some may have been more indigenous developments.
But mythology and or religion, and they very often tend to overlap, clearly, provide answers to certain crucial and inevitable questions. First and foremost among them is the one that in more or less modern philosophical expression is that simple, great, aching question, why is there anything rather than nothing? Or instead of why, we might say, how is there anything rather than nothing?
Oh, absolutely. And how did it all come about?
Exactly.
All the major questions, what happens when we die? More practical questions, why does it get cold in the wintertime? Mythology is all about trying to answer those
questions.
Well,
how does their mythology and or religion handle the question of creation?
Well, in Greek mythology, creation, everything comes out of this this chaos. It springs forth from this great yawning chasm. And there are different gods, different forces born. The earth comes out. Eros comes out, the sexual urge, and a number of others. And there are multiple generations of gods who mate with each other and produce children, and then those children eventually overthrow their parents, and then those parents are in turn overthrown by their children. So there are a great deal of conflict, which we also see in Mesopotamian mythology and religion.
Is there a prime creator god?
There really isn't. As Philip explained, everything just emerges out of chaos, and then there are successions to battle for the control of the heavens. There is no creator god in the same way as there is in the Judeo-Christian
tradition. But the most powerful of the gods, am I right in this, simply is Zeus?
Yes.
Who is he? What is he? What is he up to?
Zeus is the third generation. He's the son of Kronos. And he manages to overcome his father and seize the throne of Mount Olympus. And he and his siblings and his wives and his children constitute the 12 canonical gods that form the Greek pantheon.
The 12 canonical gods, and they are?
They are Zeus, Hera, Demeter, Poseidon, Hestia, Artemis, Aphrodite, Ares, Hermes, Hephaestus, Apollo, and Athena.
And they all have their special departments of concern.
They do. We like to say that Zeus is god of the heavens and Poseidon is god of the sea and so on. But actually, a lot of their functions overlap. I think it's wrong to see the pantheon as a cake that you slice up and say, well, this is your competence and this is yours. For instance, Poseidon is god of earthquakes, god of the sea, god of horses. We think about Athena as being the goddess of wisdom and crafts, but she's also, of course, a warrior goddess. So they actually have multiple overlapping.
And the city of Athens is named for her.
It is, yes.
She is, thus, in a sense, the patron goddess of Athens.
Well, it's named after her, or it names her as being their patron goddess. Yes.
And wasn't she represented in a great statue in the old Parthenon?
Yes, an enormous statue in the Parthenon, which does not survive, of course,
yeah.
But we have little replicas of it, which were sold to tourists, so we know it was, and we have descriptions of it, so we know it was quite impressive.
Now, one of those gods, or in this case a goddess who was of considerable interest, is Aphrodite.
Yes, the goddess of, we call her the goddess of love, but really, I think she was the goddess of sex and the sexual mm-hmm. urge much more than anything else. So she was the one who pushed people, not just people, but even animals, to reproduce. She was quite a primal force.
But these gods on Mount Olympus, they're not all one happy family, are they?
Absolutely not. They were certainly a dysfunctional family in many ways. All of the petty quarrels and disputes that human families might have are there with the gods on Mount Olympus as well.
And certain struggles have consequences which last down to this time. What struggles are they? Between the gods, I mean.
Well, there is an ongoing struggle between Zeus and Hera, who mm-hmm. are always fighting with each other.
Now, which one is Hera?
Hera is the wife of Zeus, yeah. one of the wives of Zeus. She's a goddess of many different things, but of women, women's functions in childbirth and becoming a woman and so many different features.
So the eternal conflict or stress between the sexes is represented in that particular pairing.
Well, absolutely. Zeus is powerful, and Hera can't really fight with him directly.
But so she can manipulate him.
She can manipulate him. She can deceive him. she can use all of her tricks and feminine wiles to get her will done.
Give me one story of struggles between them.
Well, during the Trojan War, Zeus was determined that the gods would stay out, at least at the beginning, out of the war. And Hera one day decided she wanted to intervene in the war. And so she dressed up in her finest clothes and put on perfume and led Zeus to a green meadow and got him to make love and then fall asleep with the help of another god and to distract him from the Trojan War.
These are gods who trod the earth all the time. They don't just come down in one special manifestation. They're in there, they're affecting and interfering with the lives of mere mortals.
They live in the world. Yeah. They're located on Mount Olympus, which is a real mountain. You can see it most days when the cloud base isn't too low. And, of course, very few people went up there, so they couldn't say, hey, look, I've scoured the whole of Olympus and I can't find the gods. But they very much lived within the world. And there are stories of people like Apollo and Hermes actually coming down and living among men in disguise. And, of course, we find that in the Homeric poems, particularly the Odyssey, all the time. Gods and goddesses come down and interact with regular mortals before they then reveal themselves.
A very basic and necessary question would be, what do we know and how can we perhaps even reconstruct the actual thought and beliefs of the Greeks of, say, the 6th or 5th century? Did they think these gods really to be godlike? Did they think they were real?
Well, most did, I think. It's hard to explain ritual. It's hard to explain the cost and the effort that goes into sacrificing to the gods. Some people in the 5th century, and Socrates perhaps would be the most famous example, had slightly different views on this, but nobody really questioned the idea that there was some sort of divine mover. It's a little different with the heroes. Now, a lot of these heroes are thought of as being children of gods, particularly Zeus, who managed to get his way with a lot of mortal women. Now, what's interesting about the heroes is nobody ever doubted their historicity. They might say, well, we don't believe that Perseus was really the son of Zeus, but nobody in antiquity, at least as far as I can tell, ever said Perseus was not a figure who lived at some point in the past.
One of the great figures in Greek story, or we can call it mythology, is Achilles, Achilleus. And he was the son of one of the gods, was he not?
He was the son of Thetis, but he was the also only half of a god.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was a demigod.
A demigod. That would be a good way of putting him. And Jonathan's absolutely right. The Greeks took these heroes extremely seriously. They were seen as the ancestors of great families.
And we mean to come to those ancestors of great families, and more particularly to that great war, the Trojan War, which you treat as of mythological significance, even though it may well have been a real war that was waged at some point, as the Greeks, most particularly the Mycenaeans, crossed over to what is now the shores of Turkey to try to take over and knock down the great city of Troy.
Oh, absolutely. You can. I took a group of students to Troy a couple of years ago. It sits right at the entrance, the waterway to the Black Sea, an extremely strategic position. And there are at least 9 different levels mm-hmm. that archaeologists have found at Troy. So, and some of those were destroyed in what seems to be war, as far as anyone can tell. So there is likely some historical kernel there.
And we are going to come to particularly the Iliad. There's no room for the Odyssey, the two great works of Homer, whoever he may have been. We might talk about that a bit as well when we return after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are wandering a bit and will do so, in the broad realm of ancient mythology, of classic mythology, with a particular focus, of course, upon the Greeks. My guests are Jonathan Hall, who is a professor of humanities and of history and is a great classic scholar at the University of Chicago, and Philip Freeman, who runs the classics department at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and is the author of the book, which is our text for tonight. And I can instantly testify it's great fun. It's very informative. It's good reading. It's titled, Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths, and just recently published by Simon & Schuster. I think the last time you were here, we talked about your biography of Julius Caesar.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was about 3 years ago. Yeah.
Wonderful book in itself. Let's come to the Iliad. And even before we begin to talk about it, I love the sound of classic Greek, of which I understand nothing. But here is a reading of the opening. The opening begins, well, what are some of the, in whatever translation, what are the English words of the very opening?
Wrath is the key word, men in
wrath, W-R-A-T.
Yes. Sorry, my English accent. yes, because that's really what it's all about. It's not about the Trojan War. It's about one man who's also named right at the beginning, Achilles, the son of Peleus.
Sing muse, the wrath of Achilles, the son of Peleus,
exactly.
Who brought a rain of woes upon the Mycenaeans.
Yes.
Who are the Mycenaeans?
Well, the Mycenaeans, the Achaeans, were the Greeks, the collection of different kingdoms in Greece who crossed the Aegean to go to war against Troy.
Now, I've got a beautiful recording of the opening, and this is the sound of classic Greek. I rather imagine this is quite authentically done. And let's listen to a minute or so of it.
Μένια έδετεα, πελέα διό Αχίλεος ουλομενέιν, εμουρία καίος αλγιέθεκε, όλιας διφυθήμους πισιου καίζι δι προϊάψεν χεροών, αυτούς δε χελόδια τευχεκιουνέσεν, ο γιονόιος ειτε δάιτα, διός δε τελέο το μπούλε, Εξχούδε τα πρώτα διαστετέν ερισάντε άτρεϊδες δι ανάξανδρον, χαίδιος Αχιλλέους, της θάρ σφοε θεόν ερίδι, ξιονέκε μακχριστάι, λετούς χαίδιος χιούς, χωγάρ βασιλέι ολόθης. Νούσον ανάστρα τον όρσικα κέιν, ο λεκόντο δε λαόι,
Unnecessary fade. It does go on for quite a while. How does that sound to you?
It sounds good. It sounds better than I could do.
Yeah.
it's beautiful, of course, in the original Greek. It's poetry. It has a rhythm to it, dactylic hexameter, mm-hmm. Usually long, short, short, long, short, short. But it's a gorgeous, it's a song, really. Which is something that is hard to come across in a translation, but it was something that Homer, or whoever Homer was, sung to people, and it's enchanting.
The standard story is Homer was, quote, a blind poet who collected all of this and put it together and did recitals up and down Greece for most of his life, and then this was taken down, and it becomes the great epic the Iliad does, and also his Odyssey, which is about one of the heroes of working his way back home, taking some 20 or 30 years.
Yes. But Homer lived, nobody really knows who exactly Homer was. Some people have said that there was more than one Homer. Some people have even suggested Homer was a woman. Homer is a convenient way of saying whoever the composer was of the Iliad.
There must have been some scholarly work on that, from textual materials to determine whether it was one man or many voices.
There's been a lot of scholarship.
And what's the outcome?
The outcome is that as each year goes by with even more scholarship, we know even less about the circumstances.
That's what scholarly dissertation does, right?
Right. There was a lot of work done earlier in the 20th century among oral poets in the Balkans. This was work conducted by Milman Parry. Which established some of the principles of oral composition. Philip just mentioned that it is a poem, and it's built up from formulae. which are almost like a jazz musician. You know, you have riffs that you put together on the spot. Some of these stories certainly go back into the Bronze Age because they talk about certain artifacts that we know weren't used after, say, the 15th or 14th centuries. But quite when they were all put together, there is... Most people now agree, I think, most literary scholars now agree, that there is some single creative genius. There is an architecture and a structure to the poem which makes it hard to believe it was composed by committee.
What was the role of the Iliad and the Odyssey in Greek life?
They came to serve as canonical texts, not canonical religious texts. There was no equivalent to the Bible or the Torah. But Herodotus, who himself says that Homer must have been about 400 years before him, but he says that Homer actually gave all the gods their names. In other words, they accepted that Homer had set down something that was enshrined forever after within Greek culture about how the Greeks should think about their gods and their heroes.
Is Herodotus right in that judgment?
No.
I thought not, yeah.
No. We now know, actually, that some of the names of the Greek gods were already around in the Late Bronze Age, at the so-called time of the Trojan War, because we've found their names in Linear B tablets, a syllabic script that was deciphered in the 1950s.
Of course, Herodotus gives us another great text, which matters tremendously to the Greeks and matters to us as we attempt to know the Greeks, even down to the present.
Yes, it's history.
There are three great Greek authors, forgetting the philosophers and the dramatists. They are Homer and Herodotus and Thucydides.
Yes, I mean, I would think they're probably even more than that, but those three would be on
any... Those are the canonical ones.
They are Herodotus and Thucydides being historians, and then Homer being a myth teller and a poet.
But they're all dealing with wars.
They are, absolutely. Yeah. Herodotus deals with the Persian War, Thucydides with the Peloponnesian War.
I've got a scene from a very strange reading of the Iliad done by the BBC, which I want to play for you and get your reaction to it, right after we pause for an update on the news, and for that to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to ancient Greece, guided there by Jonathan Hall and Philip Freeman, and guided by this fine new book by Philip Freeman titled Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. Some might argue with you because you have a full, longish chapter on the Trojan War. Some might say, well, that's not exactly mythology, it's history, even though the history may be distorted and it has mythic proportions. But it's supposed to be about real people.
Supposedly, although I think, although it may have a historical basis, I think it really is a myth for the most part.
And the gods do keep getting involved in it.
Oh, the gods are very much involved in the Trojan War, absolutely.
Give us the overview, summarize as if standing on one foot. The Trojan War.
All right.
Or rather, the Iliad.
Well, as Jonathan said, the Iliad is not the story of the Trojan War. It's the story of a very short period towards the end of the Trojan War. But what happens is that Agamemnon, who is the overall commander and king of the Greek forces at Troy, takes away the slave girl, Briseis, from Achilles. Achilles gets angry, hence the first word of the Iliad is anger or wrath. Achilles sulks. He goes to his mother, Thetis. Thetis asks her to make sure that Zeus makes the Greeks suffer and realize just how necessary he is to their war effort. She does. And so the Trojans, under their great warrior and leader Hector, pound on the Greeks pretty badly and drive them back all the way to their ships, even set a few of them on fire, until Achilles' best friend, some would say his lover, Patroclus, goes and fights against Hector. Patroclus is killed. Achilles realizes that he needs to get back into the war to avenge his friend. He goes forth and kills Hector and then takes his body back and treats it very badly.
Kills Hector in a great noble fight.
Absolutely, a great noble fight. Hector runs away at the end of it and runs around Troy several times. But he does kill Hector. He takes the body back. And at the end of it, Hector's father comes and gets the body back in a very moving scene at the end of the Iliad.
That's Priam.
Priam, yes.
Yeah. We have that wonderful scene in the film, Troy, in which Prime is played by that great English actor.
Peter O'Toole.
Yes, the Irish actor. Yes.
And after that, Troy does fall. And the Romans connected to all of that by deciding that their city was founded by a remnant of the Trojan population.
Yes, there's a line in the Iliad that says Aeneas, one of the Trojan princes, is going to survive the war and go forth. And the Romans jumped on that, and they tied themselves into the great Trojan myth by saying their ancestors were the losers of the Trojan War.
And Augustus literally commissions a great epic to celebrate that Trojan founding of Rome, and that turns out to be the Aeneid.
Virgil's Aeneid, absolutely, which Latin students have been memorizing the first few lines for centuries, yes.
Here's something strange. I don't know how close this is to Shakespeare. It's from Troilus and Cressida, which is Shakespeare's play about the Trojan War. And this is a BBC production, but in it, Achilles doesn't come off exactly as a hero. Let's hear it.
Most putrefied core. So fair without. Thy goodly armor thus hath cost thy life. Now is my day's work done. And take good breath. Rest, sword. Thou hast thy fill of blood and death. Look, Hector, how the sun begins to set. Thou ugly knight comes breathing on his heels, even with the veil and darkening of the sun to close the day up. Hector's life is done. I am unarmed. Forgo this vantage, Greek. Strike, fellow, strike. This is the man I seek. So, Ilion, fall down next. Come, Troy, sink down. Here lies thy heart, thy sinews, and thy bone. On, Myrmidons, and cry you all amain. Achilles hath the mighty Hector slain. Hark, a retire upon our Grecian part. The dragon wing of night o'erspreads the earth, and stickler-like the armies separate. My half-sup sword that frankly would have fed, pleased with this dainty bait, thus goes to bed. Come, tie his body to my horse's tail. Along the field I will the Trojan trail.
So Shakespeare treats Achilles as less the great hero than others do.
Well, I have to take Shakespeare's side on this. I've never particularly liked Achilles. Hector, when you read the Iliad, is a much more sympathetic character. So I think Shakespeare probably does a fairly good job with that.
I think that's right. It's not often said, but the count of the Trojan War in the Iliad is actually very even-handed. It's not that there are goodies and baddies. And in some ways, Achilles as a hero is just the sort of person you don't want in your community. That sort of excess of anger and wrath doesn't sit well with the Greek idea about self-containment and everything in moderation.
What does the Iliad say to us, really, about life and death? What eternal message is to be found within that vast drama?
I think it tells us about the horrors of war and the suffering of war. And again, what you have really are these two sides. And we always think, because it's written by a Greek author, that therefore the Greeks are the real subject of it. But actually, the Trojans are portrayed as the typical Greek city-state. And so it's almost like an opposition between life in what the city-state should be like and what happens when that city-state is threatened by war, in this case from the Achaeans.
Were the Trojans, in fact, Greeks? Were they Greek speakers?
Probably not. No, probably. They probably were spoken Anatolian language related to the Hittites.
But this is another interesting fact, and this goes right back to your earlier question, Milt, about the historicity of the Trojan War. There is a site that's been excavated that matches up with where Homer says Troy was. We know it was around in the late Bronze Age. We know it was a powerful city. There is some evidence of destruction, but also earthquakes, but some enemy destruction. So could this actually be the historical kernel of the Trojan War? Well, I think possibly not, because look at the circumstances of the war. But what I find most interesting is the fact that many of the Trojans, although, as Philip said, the real inhabitants of that town would have probably spoken Luwian or something, that many of the Trojans in the Iliad have Greek names. And one of them, Hector, whose name really means he who defends, he who holds the city, was the object of cult in a Greek city, Thebes. And sometimes a similar thing has been suggested also for Aeneas, that he might actually have started off as a Greek hero. So in other words, this is a Greek story that's been transplanted mm-hmm. onto the Anatolian seaboard.
Another great story of tremendous significance in Greek mythology and indeed in Greek life, and of tremendous significance in Western civilization down to the present time, as assisted very, very late in the transmission of that story by a Viennese psychiatrist named Sigmund Freud, is the story of Oedipus the King. And a quick overview, we're going to talk about that more. I'm about to pause for some commercials. But before we do, I want you to hear a quick overview of the story of Oedipus Rex, as sung by Tom Lehrer, that great satirist and songwriter and performer who had a lot of fun mocking Harvard, where he was an instructor in mathematics, but later on addressed the story of Oedipus. And here it is.
From the Bible to the popular song, there's one theme that we find right along. Of all ideals they hail as good, the most sublime is motherhood. There was a man, though, who it seems once carried this ideal to extremes. He loved his mother and she loved him, and yet his story is rather grim. Once lived a man named Oedipus Rex. You may have heard about his odd complex. His name appears in Freud's index, 'cause he loved his mother. His rivals used to say quite a bit that as a monarch he was most unfit, but still in all they had to admit that he loved his mother. Yes, he loved his mother like no other. His daughter was his sister and his son was his brother. One thing on which you can depend is he sure knew who a boy's best friend is. When he found what he had done, he tore his eyes out one by one. A tragic end to a loyal son who loved his mother. So be sweet and kind to mother now and then. Have a chat. Buy her candy or some flowers or a brand new hat. But maybe you had better let it go at that, or you may find yourself with a quite complex, and you may end up like Oedipus. I'd rather marry a duck-billed platypus than end up like old Oedipus Rex.
And to explain what lies behind that tale, we shall proceed with the story of Oedipus Rex, as conveyed by Sophocles, among others. But first, we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we come, in returning to Philip Freeman and Jonathan Hall, to one of the most piercing, one of the most disturbing of all stories in Greek mythology. And what do we know about its origins? Of course, we have it in three great plays by Sophocles about Oedipus, but it must show up earlier in Greek literature, or at least in Greek story.
There are one or two hints.
Only hints? Yes.
Certainly the earliest, fullest version we have is Sophocles' Oedipus Rex.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I mean, it shows up in Homer, I believe, at least mentioned.
It does show up in Homer.
I mean, the Oedipus is at least mentioned.
Is he mentioned as somebody who, by mistake, married his own mother?
I think so, if I remember right.
I think that goes back. I mean, to the origins, as far as we can trace them.
Yeah.
He murders his father, sleeps with his mother. What Sophocles contributes to this is not the story as such, although there are a lot of twists and turns. But it's the sheer artistry by which, as the play progresses, Oedipus finds out more and more and further back into the past about what's actually happened and why there is now a plague hitting his city.
Did the story have this the sort of wrenching centrality for the Greeks that it had, say, for Sigmund Freud, makes it the basis of the Oedipus complex?
Well, I think it certainly was terribly disturbing for the Greeks, and when they saw it portrayed, saw the play of Sophocles portrayed, and when Oedipus finds out the truth that he has murdered his father, has had sex with his mother, he blinds himself.
He's had children with his mother.
Yes, he's had children.
His daughter is his sister.
His daughter is his sister, yes. And in trying to draw a family tree, you have to use a lot of strange dots and twists and turns. But he never meant to marry his mother and have sex with her, certainly.
But the fates decreed it. Somehow this was all the gods playing with him.
And that's the most disturbing thing. The fate had decreed that he would kill his father, have sex with his mother, and Oedipus does everything he can to escape that fate. And by trying to escape it, he actually makes it happen. So it's absolutely marvelous play, and Aristotle describes it as just a wonderful play, a great example. College students nowadays, if they hadn't read it before, you can see them it's wrenching when they read it.
And of course, it touches on a very central theme. We assume we live with the sense, illusory perhaps, of being free to choose. We are what we make ourselves. Some of us have better or lesser opportunity, but finally, we are independent beings, free of any direction from elsewhere or from above us. But that is surely not the view of Sophocles. Was Sophocles, in a way, expressing the Greek view that fate orders individual lives?
I think there's an ambivalence in Sophocles and also Euripides about this. I mean, choruses often come on and say, well, this was bound to happen, the gods made it happen, or destiny made it happen. And yet you get the sense in a lot of tragedies that actually the actors do have choices at certain points, and they make the bad choice. Now, whether they're fated to make the bad choice, I think what tragedy is trying to show us is we have some control, but how limited is that control in the end, and how do we try to explain that?
Absolutely. And one thing I know with my students, when they read this, that many of them don't come from any sort of a religious background where they believe in fate, but they believe in genetics. They believe in environmental determinism. Mm-hmm. So modern versions of fate that they struggle with. So it's perhaps we don't look at it exactly the same way Sophocles did, but there are plenty of thoughts that we are not in control of our lives, at least as much as we would like to be.
Well, I mentioned Freud, of course, made so much of it in his theory of the Oedipus complex as a major source of neurotic behavior or worse. But it was Freud who said character is destiny. And destiny implies an absence of full freedom, and somehow things are fated, are preset, and will unroll, will enact as already determined. Indeed, the same thought now that it just suddenly occurs to me, is built also into some major versions of Christian theology.
Oh, yes.
I'm thinking particularly of Calvinism, which we were discussing on this program only last week in the program I mentioned earlier. Calvinism is built on the notion of predestination with regard to your ultimate destination in heaven or hell.
It's very disturbing, and it goes back, of course, to the New Testament, to the letters of the Apostle Paul and other passages. But Calvin, if you read his, I think it's the Institutes of the Christian Religion, it's disturbing how little freedom he really believed that we have in our lives.
We have none, essentially.
Yes.
According to the Institutes.
Yeah.
Nor did nor did Oedipus have particular freedom. I have here a version done by the BBC of Sophocles, that is of Oedipus Rex, Oedipus the king. He's already learned his sad fate, and he now reappears. Where is it? In Thebes? Do I have that?
Yes.
It is Thebes. And he reappears before the brother of his wife, Jocasta, who's now the ruler. And he's blinded himself. And this is played by the great British actor Michael Pennington. Here it is. It's number 7.
It's up to him now to deal with you.
He will advise us and take action as provisional governor in your place.
Hurl is coming!
It's up to him now to deal with you.
He will advise us and take action as provisional governor in your place.
Rhea, the corpse. There's nothing I can say to him.
And why should he listen to anything I say?
I've treated him unjustly.
I haven't come to crow, Oedipus, now you are down, nor to accuse you of crimes or misjudgments committed in the past. But you, people, if you have no respect for the common decencies, the sympathy due to any man's suffering, revere the sun, at least, whose warmth and brightness sustains us. The open street at the end of the day is no place for a thing unclean, cursed, and sentenced to be cast out. Not even in the open air, on the common earth, or under the rain from heaven, will he find welcome or shelter. Take him in. His sufferings are no business of the public, it's private. A question of family, grief, and prayer. A matter for his relations, not the whole city.
This is a kindness, Creon. More than I expected in my degradation. For your sake, not mine, let me ask one favor.
What favor? You need not go on your knees.
Get rid of me quickly. Deport me to some empty wasteland where the human voice is never heard.
I could have done that already, of course. But it seemed safer as a matter of priority to consult the oracle.
But the oracle has spoken unambiguously. Kill the father killer. Drive out the unclean thing. I am the man.
That's true. That's what was said. But in circumstances as extraordinary as these, it seemed safer to consult the god again.
For what? I am the cause of all this pain, and the punishment is known. What is there to ask?
Haven't you of all men learned to trust the gods?
Yes, I've learned that. One favor more I must ask or beg. The woman who lies dead in the palace, let her be buried decently with whatever formalities you think appropriate. She's your sister, your flesh and blood, and you owe her that. In my case, Thebes is my country. My homeland, though I never knew it until today, and my presence alive within her walls would be a curse on her. Let me leave and go up into my own mountains of Kithaira. My mother and father left me there to die in the wilderness, and I shall die now in accordance with their wishes who wished me dead. My death, I know, will be mysterious. My life was saved miraculously. And not for the common death of old age or sickness, but for some upending, awe-inspiring, and perhaps evil. Let it come as it will. And now, my children, the boys, Creon, Polynices, and Eteocles, they're almost men and can look after themselves wherever they go. But the girls, they're so small. Such babies yet. They have shared everything with me, food and drink and
company, I doubt if they've ever so much as eaten a meal away from their father. Look after them, Creon, for my sake. And if I could, just once more, touch them and share my tears with theirs, just once more, kindness and generosity could do no more.
A necessary fate. That is very potent. Sophocles wrote it, what, in the 5th century BC?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It works just as well, I would say.
Oh, it's tremendously moving. I mean, it's even after all of this time, it's yeah. just absolutely wonderful play.
And we are due to pause for an update on the evening's news. For that, to the WJN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight, as we roam around essentially in the broad realm of Greek mythology, are Jonathan Hall and Philip Freeman. Jonathan Hall is professor of classics at the University of Chicago, where he has been chairman of that very department. Philip Freeman is chairman of the classics department at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and the author of a number of prior books, and the one just now in hand with which I've I've enjoyed a great deal over the last few days as I've been reading in it, is titled Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. Simon & Schuster, the publishers. How many stories, mythic or close to mythic, are in the classic Greek collection? Do we have any way of reckoning that?
I'm not sure we do, but we have some authors who specialize in myths, and I suppose you could count up how many stories there are in those. One would obviously be Hesiod's Theogony. Also, later compilations, Apollodorus's library has a lot of myths. But the other thing is that we think we know these stories. They've become canonical. We've heard them in various plays, and we've seen paintings mm-hmm. about them. But in fact, it's very difficult to get a single version. And that's one of the great things of Philip's book. He gives you the stories, which seem so familiar. If you then go to the end notes, he tells you all the variants and the different versions mm-hmm. in which these stories exist.
One great story, and it's been much elaborated in musical performance and otherwise, and in film, is the story of Orpheus and Eurydice.
Yes, Orpheus was the greatest bard, the greatest poet, the greatest singer, and he fell in love with a nymph, Eurydice. And they were to be married, but on their wedding day she was bitten by a poisonous snake and died. And Orpheus loved her so much that he wanted to go down into the dark realm of Hades, into the land of the dead, and bring her back. And so he goes down and he plays his harp and he sings his songs and he charms all of the creatures of hell, Cerberus, the three-headed dog, and the rest. And Hades allows him to bring his would-be bride back up into the world as long as he does not turn around and look at her as they trod the long path back up to the surface. But of course, he gets to the end of the journey, and he can't help but wonder if she's really behind. And so he turns around and he looks, and he sees her fading away with a final word, farewell. And then he goes off and is torn apart by a bunch of women after that.
Very similar theme is to be found in the Old Testament.
Lot's wife, absolutely.
Yeah, which do you think would have come first?
Oh,
probably Lot's wife.
Probably Lot's wife. But it's I think they both are about the inability to I don't know, to look forward to the warning about not to look backwards. I don't know. It probably has deeper meaning than that.
I have here, of course, among the many great renderings of this story in more or less modern art, is Gluck's opera, Orfeo and Eurydice, Orfeo et Eurydice. Here is Janet Baker singing, I guess, the single best-known tune from that opera, Che farà senza Eurydice? What will I do without Eurydice? Here it is.
Thank you.
and a fade as we continue. Very beautifully done.
It was. It is beautiful.
That's one of the great stories that people find meaning into the present, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great love story, a story of love and of loss and the pain of love. And that's something you see in most of the Greek myths about love and lovers.
And the death of a beloved is but an also, eternal and recurring human burden.
But also I think what's interesting about it is the possibility, which is not finally realized, but the possibility that you can conquer death. I think here's an important area where we have a myth that is serving some sort of function, because there was a group called the Orphics. We would probably consider them now something more like a cult or a sect. Mm. But it involved its own philosophy that wasn't entirely in tune with standard views about the Greek gods. And we have a lot of tablets which we've managed to decipher and understand some of the teachings of this cult. And there is certainly something about trying to overcome death or trying to find some sort of afterlife, which was not actually a common conception in Greek thought.
That's part of still a larger Greek theme, is it not? The theme of hubris, of presuming to challenge the power of the gods, and thus challenge fate. Prometheus is a central, and the Promethean story is a central figure in that regard, isn't it?
Yes, and Prometheus is one of the early gods who stands up to Zeus. He challenges him in ways by bringing down fire to mankind when Zeus really didn't want it to happen. And he is punished, of course, by being chained to a rock in the mountain and having his liver picked out by an eagle
forever,
for at least for a very long time. Yeah. And because he's a god, his liver grows back every day. But the Greeks were very much attuned to the idea of hubris, about reaching too far.
Another such story has to do with attempting to fly.
Daedalus and Icarus, story of Daedalus, who is the great architect of the labyrinth in Crete. And he did such a good job that he was kept there by King Minos. And he wanted to escape. He wanted to go back home. So he built wings for his son and for himself. And they set off, and it worked. They flew. But Icarus, of course, flew too close to the sun and hit the wax on his wings, melted, and he crashed into the sea dead.
There is a wonderful poem by Winston Auden about that, but with a special interesting angle, which we might talk about in just a moment, and we might hear the poem as read by Auden right after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I was promising you a poem by Winston Auden. He went to a museum in Brussels and was very impressed by this poem, this picture, it's a rather famous one, by Bruegel the Elder. And in it, we see lots of people. Somebody's plowing a field, kids are playing, there's a ship in the distance, but still quite visible. And looking very, very far away, we see the legs of Icarus, just as he's falling into the water. He's barely, it's labeled the fall of Icarus or something, and therefore the problem is, where's Icarus? And when Auden saw it, he was quite amused and bemused, and he wrote the following poem, which we hear read by him.
About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course. Anyhow, in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life, and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away, quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone, as it had to, on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on.
What about that?
Oh, it's wonderful. I love the painting. I wasn't familiar with the poem, I think the Greeks would have appreciated that too, because the story of Icarus is a story of hubris, as we were talking about, and so it puts him in his place.
But he's also saying, look how inconsequential to ordinary people some of these very, very strange and memorable events are.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
It sort of chides us for being insensitive, doesn't it?
I think so. I think so, definitely.
Yeah. What are some other... I've been hitting a few of the well-known stories. We've got about 10 minutes before we will pause for a quick newscast and then to the phones. Indeed, I might say to our listeners right now, if you want to raise a question, offer a thought, refer and reflect upon some other item in Greek mythology that has particularly bemused you over the years, we're ready for you. 312-591-7200. The lines are open right now. 312-591-7200. If you'd rather reach us via email, and that's particularly appropriate for our overseas listeners, the way to do that is go to WGNradio.com, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at WGNradio.com, or for phones 312-591-7200. If you want to be sure to be heard, get in there quickly, and if you don't mind waiting for just a few minutes, we'd be delighted to have you on board. But in the 10 minutes or so we've got left, I've been pushing some particular items from Greek mythology upon you. What are some others that continue to bemuse or fascinate you?
Well, I think one myth that pulls together a couple of themes we've talked about this evening, the first being gods feuding between one another, and the other, most recently, hubris that we've been talking about, that would be the myth of Hippolytus. And this involves the two goddesses, Artemis and Aphrodite. Philip's already talked about Aphrodite as the goddess of desire, sexual desire. And Artemis, of course, is the virgin. She's the virgin huntress. And Hippolytus is a bastard son of Theseus, and he's committed his life to hunting and to chastity, and he therefore doesn't give Aphrodite the due worship that she expects. So she causes Theseus's wife, Phaedra, to fall in love with him. And Phaedra comes on, if you like, to Hippolytus, and he repulses her, and she is so ashamed that she commits suicide. But rather, like Potiphar's wife, she writes a letter saying that Hippolytus had tried to rape her. And when Theseus comes home and finds the letter, he calls down the curses from his father, the god Poseidon, and Hippolytus is killed in an accident where he's in his chariot, and a sea monster arises out of the ocean and causes him to have an accident.
What are we to make of that?
I think on a very basic level, what the Greeks took away from that was that you may have favorites among the divinities, but you have to give them all their due honor. But I think at a slightly deeper level, it's really about trying to find a balance in your life, a balance between self-moderation, self-restraint, but also giving in occasionally to your desires and not trying to stifle them too much.
Didn't Corneille make a play of this? The Phaedra, isn't it based upon?
Phaedra, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. There are so many others. I'd like to turn everybody back to Homer and urge everyone to go out and read the Odyssey if they haven't read it yet, because it's a marvelous story that works at many different levels, fighting monsters, but also it's a tremendous love story and a great struggle that Odysseus goes through, but also Penelope goes through, his wife back home, just as horrendous and difficult as her husband is going to through as he sails past whirlpools and fights off monsters and sirens. So that, I think everyone should go out and read that.
Never understood why it took him so long to to get back to home. What Greek state does he go back to?
He goes back to the little island, the little insignificant island of Ithaca on the western coast, a very poor place. But he was sidetracked by a number of different things, including goddesses who kept him as a lover for a while.
Particularly... in what would be Tripoli, I guess, or near it.
Yes. I mean, it's these are mythological places, so we really don't know. But Calypso keeps him for a while. He dallies with Circe for a while. And he seems to spend a lot of time doing some raiding on the way home, I guess, to add to his treasure. So a bit of it is his fault, but not all of it.
And Penelope has been fending off all these men who are pursuing her. So they are suitors.
Right.
With the story about the thing she's weaving, how does that go?
Yes, she says that, gentlemen, I really can't make a decision yet about marrying you. I need to make a burial shroud for my husband's father. And they're very sympathetic about this. And she weaves this during the day, but at night she tears it apart.
Yes.
So she never finishes it. But she is undergoing an odyssey every bit as much as her husband is.
We have a strong ending when, finally, Odysseus... returns.
Yes, when he returns in disguise. He sneaks his way back into the house, finally reveals himself to his son and to a few others, and he kills all of the suitors. And he wins back his wife. It's a tremendous love story.
He's a man of considerable passion.
He is, absolutely.
Yeah. What are some of the other stories that have come down with some special relevance and still get repeated, maybe even when we're talking to children?
Oh, goodness. So many of these stories really are not fit for children in their original
form.
There's
so much incest and murder.
There's so much incest, and Zeus is a serial rapist, and really you have to change these stories quite a bit. But the stories of Odysseus, again, are very popular. The stories of the monsters certainly are always popular with children.
Why is there so much incest and murder in these mythological tales? Even beyond the Iliad and the Odyssey. What does that tell us about the Greeks?
Well, it tells them that this is an issue that deeply disturbs them, and that there are many different interpretations of what work myth is trying to do, but one of them is to try to work through basic emotions and psychological conditions, and this is one. Another very common feature is of a lot of the myths that Philip collects in his book is the idea of a father or a grandfather who fears that he's going to be usurped or killed even by his son or grandson, and invariably then keeps his daughter in some sort of seclusion so that she can't be raped by someone. And it clearly responds to an anxiety about the protection of self and family.
Is it merely an anxiety, or is it an anxiety based in some reality about the way the Greeks really lived in, about the way the Greek elite struggled to replace one another?
It could be seen as that. I don't think many elites lost a lot of sleep thinking that their sons were going to overthrow them, but I think it's probably more to do with the human condition and ideas of mortality.
Simone Weil, when she wrote about the Greeks, made a great deal of just how brutal they were in war, and how brutal they were to one another, if only in the struggles between the separate city-states.
Well, they were, but I don't think they were any more brutal than the Romans or the people of Egypt or Mesopotamia, really. I don't think the Greeks were involved in incest or cannibalism or any of the things in their myths. But I think Jonathan's absolutely right. It talks more about human anxiety.
Finally, is there any lasting reassurance that comes from the Greek mythic view of reality, or the Greek mythic view of the human condition and of human fate?
Well, it's a question I discuss with students in classical mythology courses, and I think there are lessons, certainly, that we can learn in our own lives about the importance of love from the Odyssey, the importance of not overreaching yourself, not falling into the trap of hubris. There are many lessons, I think, that we can take away from Greek mythology.
Is there consolation? After all, the trouble with life as we know it is that it's, to use Hobbes's term, and maybe it isn't as nasty as it once was, but nasty, brutish, and short. Short is the greatest burden of all. Short is a reference to death. And the one thing that human beings have always struggled with is their knowledge that we die. And they find reassurances through, essentially through, the stories that sustain us via religious faith. For a secular age, and in the West, we are blessed or burdened by living essentially in a post-religious age. Many of us are, particularly people who work at universities, it has been my observation. And so that the ultimate burden is the knowledge of the finitude of our existence. It will end and it won't recur again. Do the Greeks sustain us somehow in facing that?
I'm not sure they do, by and large, although there are some exceptions. As I mentioned the Orphics earlier, there are also a lot of mystery cults that from the 5th century onwards become more and more important, and they offer myths which have a different sort of outcome, myths which do promise some kind of afterlife, some sort of redemption. But most of the myths that Phillips collected make for some pretty gloomy prognoses, I would have thought.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one lesson the Greeks are trying to teach us, is that death is real and it's going to happen to you, so you better face it and make the most of life while you can. Mm-hmm. Because the afterlife in Greek mythology, for the most part, is pretty dark and gloomy.
This same flower that blooms today, tomorrow shall be dying.
Yes, it's a hard lesson to learn, but I think the Greeks, for the most part, tried to teach us that.
Yeah. We're about to pause for the usual reasons. Right after, I earnestly invite telephone calls, questions, or comments. Certainly questions about yet other of the great Greek stories, and Roman ones as well. 312-591-7200. Or if there's any particular myth that has persisted, though you learned it when you were a child, you still think about it, perhaps even brood about it. If you want to talk about it, do by all means give us a call. Your adventures with classical mythology, or your questions about classical Greek mythology. Now is the time. And I ask my regular listeners, get in there. We want to hear from you. It's really quite important to get some good and interesting phone calls at this very moment. Similarly, we, of course, welcome email from wherever you may be located.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And before we go to the phones, 312-591-7200, a special invitation. We're organizing a kind of contest. It's very simple. Can you name at least 10 of the major Greek gods? The first person to do so successfully by calling us at 312-591-7200. The first person who names 10 or more, to be sure, of the Greek gods without a mistake will get a free copy of the book by Philip Freeman that we've been drawing from, Oh My Gods, a modern retelling of Greek and Roman myths. So, name 10 of the Greek gods at least at 312-591-7200. The first one to do it successfully gets the book, so get in there quickly. If you've got other questions you want to raise or thoughts you want to share concerning Greek and Roman mythology, we are, of course, eager to hear from you. And we'll go to the first caller with that. Larry has joined us. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hello. I don't think I know any of the Greek mythology, so I'm not going to go to that one. My question is, I'm concerned with Thor.
Is Thor?
Greek or Roman?
Thor is a Norse god. He is centered up in Scandinavia, so Sweden, Norway, Iceland. He especially lives in Iceland. His cult continues there for a long time, but he's not Greek or Roman.
That is interesting, though, isn't it? We haven't said anything about comparable or parallel kinds of mythology as they develop elsewhere in the world.
Well, it's interesting. The Norse gods are, some of them, they're in very similar to the Greek and Roman gods in many ways, but they don't have much human interaction. The stories about the Norse gods all seem to take place in Asgard, and they certainly don't visit Earth very much.
We do have parallel mythologies and parallel kind of god stories from neighboring areas, though not from Greece itself. In recent years, wasn't there a fair amount of scholarship on sort of great heroic mythological epics as they flourished in other parts of the Balkans. There was somebody who did a major work on a great Yugoslavian epic.
Milman Perry that Jonathan yes. mentioned earlier, yes, about oral poetry.
I don't think that was so much about mythology, though, as about battles which had a semi-historical status.
I see. The gods didn't intervene there as much as they did.
I don't believe so.
In,
no.
say, Troy.
Now, but there are plenty of parallels from cultures all around the world. Yeah. Certainly Indo-European cultures, India, Iran, the Celtic mythology from Ireland and Wales and elsewhere. There are plenty of parallels.
Let's go to the first caller who wants to try to name the gods. That would be Carrie. And good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. So here I go. See if I don't get too nervous and... So, Zeus, Hermes, Poseidon, Hades, Athena, Aphrodite, Hephaestus,
Persephone.
Yes, I'm trying to refer to Hades' wife. Thank you. And I don't think I got to 10 yet.
You got to 8.
I got to 8.
Close, but no cigar.
Yes. Thank you very much.
We thank you for the call. Good try. Were all of those correct?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Well, let's try another. 312-591-7200. And we will go next to Chris. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
All right.
How about Zeus? Poseidon? So far?
Hermes. So far, you're right.
Yes.
Hermes, Hades, or Pluto. Athena, Apollo, Aphrodite. How many I got so far?
You got 7.
Did I say Ares?
No, I don't
no,
think
you
so.
Didn't, no.
Okay.
That's 8.
Hera.
Yep.
And did I say Poseidon?
You said Poseidon already.
Okay. Demeter.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. You got it. All 10. All right. Now, listen, hang on. Oh, let me ask you a question, though, first. Where did you open a book to find that, or was it in your head?
Well, I used to study a lot of that back in the day. I really had to pull that out of a hat there.
Where did you study that?
In college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's has it remained of some interest for you then?
It has somewhat. Good. That is very interesting.
Now, here's the thing to do. Stay with us, and our producer will collect your name and address, and we will see to it that you get a copy of this book. All right?
Thank you so much.
All right, let's do it this way. And we'll go to another caller. And all the other callers have disappeared, I gather, because they should call anyway to talk about Greek mythology if they have any such interest. And anyone else who has such interest, get in touch very quickly with a question or a comment about Greek mythology. 312-591-7200, the number. 312-591-7200 for email extension 720@wgnradio.com. And we shall return after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will return to the phones for your questions to Messrs. Hall and Freeman. Jonathan Hall, professor of classical history at the University of Chicago, the Classics Department. Philip Freeman, who heads the Classics Department at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and is the author of the new book, Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. And we'll go directly back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And next up is Valerie. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Milt, and hello to your guest. My question is more just reciting, you know, one of my favorite Greek stories being that about Arachne, who was a very great weaver at the loom and would create these incredible tapestries, mm-hmm. mainly because her father had the special dyed wool, and that particularly made it good, but she thought it was all her. And so the Athena happened to come by, and she chose to pick her as to duel with her and make a tapestry, you see, because she said, I can make one as beautiful as you. And she was, of course, a commoner. And so everybody was interested, and they set out, each of them making their own tapestries. And in the end, Arachne made a tapestry showing all the gods getting into all sorts of trouble and liaisons with people they weren't supposed to, and how the common people had to suffer for the gods, you know, frivolities and trivialities.
Now, why does that story grab you?
Well, I liked it because, in the end, the girl's pride, it was another one of those pride things, was when Athena got mad at her attempt to be better than a goddess, mm-hmm. and then also then, not only did she do that, which was a real kind of kick in the pants, but it was also like, and look what I showed, you know, which was totally no respect of you folks and all your non-godlike ways. And that's when Athena got really mad and turned her into a spider. And that's why we have that, the idea of arachnophobia or that classification of spiders being or arachnids.
Yeah, yeah.
And I genus, used to teach it to my seventh graders.
Uh-huh.
And they absolutely just loved it. It was just part of a overall literature, some world literature, and they could not get enough of these stories, and was so exciting to them. And so it was kind of, in a way, just like Icarus falling into the sea, that idea of when we try to, we have too much pride and don't give them their common due, you know, then that's when we get stuck.
It's a great
down.
Greek lesson. Pride goeth before a fall.
Oh, and it shows up in so many different Greek myths. So, yeah. And I'm not at all surprised that your students love it. It's it just shows up again and again.
It does.
Matt, thank you. Very nice call.
Thank you.
Very glad to have heard from you. 312-591-7200 is the number. And next up is Vanessa. Good evening. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Milt. I'm participating in an online discussion of the Iliad right now, and we had a question about Helen's supposedly the cause of the Trojan War,
mm-hmm.
and Menelaus, her husband, is trying to get her back, but she was actually given to Paris by Aphrodite. So we would the question I'm wondering is, there's some question of whether she went willingly, whether she was kidnapped, and later on Helen says she's actually guilty for having started the war. And we're just having trouble trying to interpret this. If she was actually given to Paris, then why would she be guilty? Why would there be the war? Or are we supposed to just look at Aphrodite as a personification of desire? And, you know, if we think of her as a real god, then she's the one who's pulling all the strings.
It's a very interesting question.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody said the gods were fair. And Aphrodite's giving away a married woman. And you're right, in the Iliad, Helen gets up on the walls of Troy and says, oh, you know, I'm the cause of this whore that I am.
Right.
And it's, it is disturbing. And we're really not sure if she does it willingly or not. And again, I would recommend the Odyssey. There's a wonderful scene after the war where she and Menelaus are sitting at home back in Sparta and telling stories. And I think it reveals some wonderful insights about Helen. She is a fascinating character.
Yeah. So do we take it? Well, we don't know if Aphrodite is considered just a personification, or are we supposed to take it as she really did give Helen as a gift, or we just don't know?
Well, in the story, I mean, she really did give her away as a gift, but you're also right that she is a personification of Eros, of uh-huh. sexual desire, of course.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Glad to have heard from you. Here's an email from a listener in Palm Springs, California. James Christian is his name. And he says, While some of the great works of the Greeks and Romans have survived and been passed down to those of us living in the modern age, many other works haven't. Hesiod's Theogony, or is it Theogony, isn't it?
Theogony.
Hesiod's Theogony survived, but other works like the Titanomachia didn't. The Odyssey only resurfaced much later in the 15th, 16th century, I believe. How do we know that the myths that have been passed down are the most accurate or complete stories? For example, the story of Orion the Hunter, within my copy of Bullfinch's Mythology, which I've had from age 7, are different from other versions from other sources.
That's a very interesting question.
By the way,
question.
What is the Titanomachia?
That's the Battle of the Titans, which some of your listeners will know from the Clash of the Titans movies
that have come out
several times. Is a myth accurate or is it just a story? I would say that there are no accurate myths. We are used to receiving myths in written form, in compendia such as Philip's written. But most of the Greeks, for much of the period we've been discussing, would have been used to hearing them. And they would have actually heard different versions because those myths were performing different functions for different communities at different times. So there is no one authoritative, canonical version of a myth.
Yeah, absolutely. We get multiple variations. And I try to point out in my book, whenever possible, that there were a great many. And the Odyssey, by the way, was well known in the ancient world. It wasn't just discovered during the 15th century.
And with that, let's go back to the phones. Next up, I see, is Jim, who's reached us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Hi. Yes. I had been only heard part of your show tonight, which is always interesting, but I wondered if your guests could comment on, I know this is there's been a number of these, but the depiction of mythological stories in film and also of historical stories in film, for example, 300, which obviously was a crazy depiction of that. And finally, number 14 down in today's New York Times is mythical figure blinded by Enopian. I don't know if they can help me with that.
Say that one again.
Oh, it's mythical figure blinded by Enopian.
Enopian?
Enopian.
I don't know that one.
Wow. Okay.
No.
Well, yeah, okay, well, I'll work on that, but maybe you could... I was wondering what your feeling on the films were.
Well, there are so many films. 300 is just one of many. And 300, of course, was based on a graphic novel and a comic book. And I think for representing a comic book, it does a great job.
But the original story is to be found in Herodotus, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yeah, the battle at Thermopylae between the Greeks and the Persians. But in the film, you have Xerxes, who's about 9 feet tall and uses armored rhinoceroses. And obviously, it's not reflecting the reality of what really happened there. But there's some wonderful movie versions. Of the O Brother, Where Art Thou? Is a retelling of the Odyssey, I think, is really good. Cold Mountain, also a book and a subsequent movie, is a wonderful a version of the Odyssey. So there are quite a few good ones out there.
Jason and the Argonauts, I remember, with the stop-motion effects of the skeletons, and was an amazing, you know, before, a lot of them that were done before digital were just amazing feats of cinematic depictions.
Oh, absolutely.
But like even the more serious depictions of the actual events, not just sort of the allegories in modern movies. I mean, are there any that stand out for you? Or,
well, I'd come back to 300 because I think it's actually come in for a lot of bad press. As Philip says, it's based on a graphic novel, and that graphic novel is based loosely on Herodotus. But we're acting as if Herodotus is actually the accurate depiction of what happened, and certainly the figures that Herodotus gives on the Persian side are clearly inflated. I mean, it's just impossible that there were that many soldiers and sailors on the Persian side. So I think, as with 300, also with all of the myths that we've been talking about, they are told and retold, and they're told differently each time, and each has its own virtues and sometimes counter-virtues.
And we thank you, sir, for the call. We'll go directly and quickly to another, that other being John. Good evening, sir.
Yes, sir. I was wondering if if these gentlemen have any knowledge of any connection in history between the Semitic gods, the Elohim, and the Greek gods, the pantheon of the Greek gods. Is there any connection there in actual development?
I don't think there's a lot of connection. The Greeks certainly were very much influenced by Near Eastern mythology, and especially in some of their early creation stories and generational warfare. But I at least I don't know of any strong connection between the Jewish tradition and the Greeks.
Well, when you're treating Elohim, you're working toward the achievement of monotheism. And thus there aren't. There isn't a plurality of gods.
Elohim is plural.
Yes, but I say you're working towards monotheism.
There was a Semitic pantheon of gods, and
we know that
the
from
Israelite
the
Israelite came out of.
We know
of
that from the Old Testament. Moses gets very angry with the people of Israel as they begin while he's up on Sinai to fool around with other gods.
It's often difficult.
It's actually in the Old Testament where Yahweh is the God. He's the son of a mother and a male and a female god,
mm-hmm.
and he's got a consort, and they worship. These worshippers in the old Israel worshipped Yahweh and his consort. They prayed to them.
Yeah, and
as one of many gods.
Well, that's what I've said. They're working toward monotheism
in
those stories.
I see.
But let's get a further comment from Jonathan Hall.
Yes, to return to your question, John, it's often difficult to know whether what look like structural resemblances between elements of the pantheon in two different culture areas are actually a result of direct borrowing and influence, or whether they've arisen independently. For instance, the story of Noah and the flood, well, we have a Greek functional equivalent to that in Deucalion and a flood, a very similar story, but we don't know whether that story was borrowed or whether it occurred to them independently. There is one case that I can think of off the top of my head where there is a sort of assimilation between a Semitic god and a Greek god, and that's the case of Melkart, who was a Phoenician deity, who was thought of by the Greeks as being Heracles. And there are some places throughout the Mediterranean where we have evidence for Phoenicians and Greeks where that god is worshipped.
I see by the clock that we're approaching the end of the available time. Gentlemen, I thank you most sincerely for joining us tonight. Let's make very clear that our guests have been Jonathan Hall and Philip Freeman, and that the new book that has been sort of the basis of our conversation tonight is the one by Philip Freeman titled Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths, and that's just recently published by Simon & Schuster. And I can testify that it's very delightful and very informative reading. A few quick words about things to come, most particularly tomorrow night. Tomorrow night we are having our annual night at the opera, that is at the Lyric Opera. My guests, three in number, will be one of the leading singers in the current season and the new general manager of the Lyric, Anthony Freud, who's come over from the UK only this year, I do believe. Also with us is Roger Pines, who is the dramaturg for the Lyric and has been with us often. And as I say, one of the leading singers, be determined by tomorrow. And by tonight, it is time in just a few seconds to wind down after a quick reminder that you can hear literally hundreds of podcasts of this program at our particular Facebook location, which is simply Facebook/Milt Rosenberg. Until tomorrow at 10, thanks to all for listening and a most cordial good night.